kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. We have people all over the world who are interested in looking at the problem in a way that we all benefit from its solutions. We focus upon empowering people. That's what makes us different. We do not discriminate against age or background, so everyone has a chance to live a longer, healthier, happier life. We can all participate in solutions. That's why the average age of the person coming 10 million last week to my Facebook was 34 years of age and proactive. To honor the people in this audience, we try to select the topics that give you insights that the mainstream media or even the alternative media does not. For example, today, Robert Perry, multi-award-winning investigative journalist from Washington, D.C., formerly the Washington Post, a George Polk Award winner, and a National Reporting Award winner. He's going to talk about the media, the CIA takedown of Gary Webb. He will be joined by activist, founder of Soft Skull Publishing, which won Outstanding Independent Publishing of the Year Awards, and was responsible for the biography of George Bush, Fortunate Son. His name is Sonder Hicks. He'll be on, too, talking about the CIA, major media, working together to stop Gary Webb. Many of you may not know who Gary Webb was. I knew Gary Webb very well. We had many conversations, meetings together. He's the one who was the first to expose, in a very important series of articles, the CIA allowing drugs into Southeast Los Angeles in the 1990s. And he was literally destroyed because of it. There's a new movie opening about his life this week. So it's time that we all got on the same page about what actually happened. The movie's called Kill the Messenger. Today we're going to look at health and nutrition as we always do. We're going to look at the organic foods you consume can give you a 21% lower risk of a disease. How centella, that's gota, as in gota cola, well, the most commonly used, if not the most commonly used herb in the world, attenuates diabetes-induced hippocampal changes. In lay language, it's something very good if you're diabetic. How diet can impact the risk of inflammatory bone disease by changing gut bacteria. That might seem a little complicated. We'll make it simple. What you eat, if it's the right food, creates the right bacteria, turns off inflammation, which can prevent bone disease. Monsanto scandal causes reopening of the U.S. investigation on GMOs in wheat. Then thirst turns to desperation in rural California, from the New York Times. They're talking about how bad it really is. Well, they're a little behind. It's a lot worse. We've actually reached out to every single community in Texas and California. The numbers are staggering. How many people are within days to the most a year, and then their water's gone. Also today on this program, you will hear Michael Moore. You'll also hear Bill Maher. You'll hear a debate. You'll hear a different perspective than Maher's. You'll hear what Michael Moore, and I told him this, I know Michael very well. We just had a conversation last week. But I remember when he was supporting Obama, and I said, do you know this about him? And I went through a whole litany of where he got his money, how he never was a part of any community movement to protect the low-income tenants of Chicago. He was on the opposite side of that. The media missed it. They just took the press releases as factual, biographical information. Also today, you'll hear Michio Kaku, Helen Collicott. You hear the best voices in science in America talking about Fukushima, what we weren't told, the truth of it. And I don't know what else we'll have time for, but I have more to go if we have extra time. So as you see, we have a packed show. All issues that are not being covered by the mainstream media. Let's begin. there's this debate going on, and it's a legitimate debate, and I certainly see where there's reasonableness on both sides. One side says that we should buy organic, certified organic. The other side says that we should buy local grown. Their argument is this. The organic says that organic doesn't have the pesticides, herbicides, is not GMO, protects nature. And the local grown says, you may be correct, but if you buy it locally grown, you're not paying all that money and having all that carbon footprint flying it, boating it, or driving it by truck from point A, which may be in Mexico or Central America, to someplace in Maine. So you're really shipping something 5 to 10,000 miles. And look at what you're doing to the environment. Here's my thoughts. I believe they are both correct, but they are not uniquely exclusive. The solution, it is relatively straightforward and simple. I taught this in my first class at the first community organic teaching farm in New York State, the Fertiller Farm that I opened in 1971-72. Grow organic locally. Meet with local farmers. You can meet them at the farmers markets and say, you have all this produce here. I would buy that, your tomatoes, your string beans, your peaches, if it was organic. You would also be getting a whole new market, and that has been the case. So now what we're seeing from just one or two certified organic farmers 10 years ago at a local farmers market to more than half of the produce, people are lining up at those that are certified organic, and they are not, some of them are not inexpensive. For example, there's one that produces outstanding produce, but it's $12 for 3 ounces. And that's a lot of money. There are others that are now coming in that are also organic and underpricing them. Give you an example. On Sunday, I went to the local market, and there were two stalls side by side. One was the only competitor, just a few for the last 10 years, and you could easily spend $60 if you had a wide variety of different greens that you were buying. Now, mind you, you couldn't buy these in any store. They had at least 30 types of microgreens that were just unique, tasty, delicious, but they were expensive. Not everyone could afford them. Now you have this fellow that opened up a place right beside them, and they give you a whole bag. And I got a whole brown bag of organic leaf lettuces for $1.60. And I said, how do you do it? And he said, well, he said, I have a small farm, and I want people to know that if they can't afford the high prices there, they can afford what I'm giving them. He didn't have all the fancy containers. He didn't have a whole staff. It was just him with wooden crates, but he was growing organic. Now, he historically was not an organic farmer. He just saw demand, and he met it with a supply. Now, what that'll do in time, it'll cause all of them to bring down their prices. So the guy who's charging, you know, $40 for a bag of sunflower sprouts is going to have to come way down, or he will lose out in the competition. So we need more competition in the organic movement. We need more innovators. But we have lots of locally grown produce that are now organic. So you don't have to have either or. And also there are buying clubs. Doesn't take many people. You could have, let's say, 10 friends and associates, and you go to a farmer and say, here's the list of items that we'd like grown. You have a greenhouse, you could grow them in the winter or in inclement weather. You have land outside, outside growing. You have fruit trees, and you give them a list. Then you pay them in advance against what you're going to purchase. That way the farmer is growing specifically and exclusively for you. Now think of that if you're a farmer. It means you've got your income. You can pay your mortgage or your bills or your electricity. You can pay for your seed. You're not in debt. Historically, farming starts off with debt. You have to take out loans to get your supplies, equipment. If you're a traditional farmer or a commercial farmer, you're going to have to pay for pesticides, herbicides, tractors, combines, etc. And you better hope that you have a good season. You don't have drought or flooding. And then you work against that. And that's why half of all of small American farms went bankrupt in the 1980s when the interest rate went to 22%. They weren't making 22%, so they just went in debt, lost everything. So now you go to a person, you say, up in Goshen, where you got great black dirt. I owned a black dirt farm at one time up there. And you say, there are 10 of us, or 20, or 30, however many. Here's what we'd like. And because we're paying for it in advance, we want this at no cost. The farmers made their money up front. So when you then go to get your harvest every week, and you generally do it by having someone put everything into boxes, and everyone gets their box of whatever is being grown. It's just a very innovative and a different way of doing it, but it will work better than anything. You save money. You get something grown year-round, organic. The farmer doesn't have debt, knows they have a guaranteed crop they can grow. It's a win-win for everyone. That's the next step. That's where I see a lot of people going. And by the way, I'm always trying to help people who have great ideas but do not have the money and cannot afford to do a business on their own. I've helped a lot of people, and I don't ask anything for it. I just like to see people who are innovative and motivated succeed. You can always reach out. We have many people. If you went in yesterday, there's a brand new sandwich that was made, and it's a phenomenal sandwich. It's like a foot-long sandwich. I don't know how long it is, but it looks like that. But all organic vegetables grilled with a special mbachi tofu sauce, a dill sauce. It's delicious. That was created by a person that was homeless just a year ago. Now has their own little business, because all they needed was a couple breaks and a little help. Now they're on their feet. There's no reason that we shouldn't have more people doing innovative things. So sometime in the next month, I'll set aside a day or an evening to have a free workshop for people who have ideas but don't know what to do with them, don't know, maybe they don't have the money or all the skills, and I'll try to help you take it from an idea, concept, to a fulfillment. All right? I believe if you have a gift in life, we have a spiritual obligation to share that gift. Just what I believe. So that is why organic versus local, it doesn't have to be either or. If you do eat organic, here's some good news, and this is from the British Medical Journal Open. It says pregnant women may be able to lower their risk of potentially deadly complications known as preeclampsia by more than 20% by simply eating more organic vegetables. That was done at the National Institute for Consumer Research and the Norwegian Institute for Public Health. Quote, the result is intriguing and supports that diet during pregnancy can influence risk of preeclampsia. So that's good news. Eat organic. If you're pregnant, you have a much better opportunity to have a healthy, developed child. Energy drinks are touted all over. You've all seen them. Well, here's what you haven't heard. This is from the Camilo José Cela University in Spain. Energy drinks cause insomnia, nervousness in athletes. Quote, a study analyzing the positive and negative effects of energy drinks on athletes has seen that, although in principle their sports performance has seemed to improve by 3% to 7%, there was also an increase in the frequency of insomnia and nervousness and the level of stimulation in the hours following the competition. Now, we've seen a remarkable increase in this. Here's something else I've noticed. Now, I won't mention the brand, but when I did the National 40K Championship in August, it was a brutally hot day, hilly course, lots of judges, heavy competition, I set up on my tables. You could put your own beverages. On a short race, you're not allowed to, but in a long race beyond 10K, you can. So I had all these enclosed cups, and I had blended grape juice, because the power of the grape and the electrolytes in it, the coconut water, because of electrolytes and potassium in particular, and also a few other combinations of nutrients that I put in there to help with my electrolyte, because 40K is 24.8 miles. It's only a mile less than a marathon. Every single person had one of those super caffeinated beverages. I mean, I looked at the milligrams. One had over 400 milligrams, and they were going to be having that throughout the whole race. So I'm doing the calculation. I'm thinking that person's taking virtually a lethal level of caffeine during this race. Could literally kill him. Could cause a heart attack. And I tried to explain. But I don't have a right before a race to freak anybody out. I just suggested, I hope you're drinking a lot of water. Water's what you really need during the race. Now, these are experienced athletes. These are all people who are champions. Well, we did the race. Everyone lost weight because you're perspiring profusely. I had no problems at all. My energy was up, electrolytes balanced, and afterwards I had a nice come down, but it was even. 20 minutes after I finished the race, I was just fine. I also set a new American record and won. Overall, all competitors in all age groups, male, female, and that felt really good because I did what everyone said it was an impossibility. You couldn't do it. But I did it. It's there. It's on the record books. It happened. What I did notice was how absolutely hyper other people were. I mean, their bodies were physically shaking. So I went over to some and I tried to explain that this was the effect of the caffeine on the central nervous system and they shouldn't do this in the future. Whether they will or won't do it in the future, all I know is stay away from energy drinks, stay away. Stay away from the caffeinated beverages. Keep them out of your life. They are extremely dangerous. They can cause strokes. And once you come down, your body can't just come down to normal where your blood pressure comes down, your blood sugar comes down, your body temperature normalizes. It won't happen. You're going to be, for 24 hours, your body's going to be trying to rebalance itself through homeostasis. Not good. And so this study simply showed that that's correct. And finally, two things. Research data from the University of Malaya talked about Gota Cola. Now, we don't use Gota Cola, Gota, G-O-T-U, Cola, K-O-L-A. It's the most commonly used herb in the world. Behind that is ginseng. But they did this and they found that it attenuates diabetes-induced hippocampal changes. And that is important. Here's what it says, quote, therefore, the aim of this study was to investigate the protective role of this on the hippocampus in diabetes, and they found that it did. So what you have to understand is anything that can help modulate your brain function, if you're diabetic, can make a difference. Because frequently diabetics suffer from stroke, dementia, and Alzheimer's, and Parkinson at a much higher level. So if there's something that will help you, that's good. And this helps the hippocampus, especially if you're diabetic. And finally, this is from a study done both in the United States and Belgium, published in the most respected journal in the world, Nature. Quote, diet may fuel or dampen susceptibility to auto-inflammatory bone disease by changing the intestinal bacterial balance. Now, what it is in lay language is they found that a diet that limited the growth of intestinal bacteria also protected the species and reduce the production of immune modules, what are called interleukin-1b, which promotes inflammation. So in just real lay language, if you eat a diet rich in vegetables and fruits and nuts and seeds, legumes, you will turn off inflammation. It will also have good probiotics. Fermented food like sauerkraut, kimchi, promotes healthy bacteria in your gut. Healthy bacteria also works to turn off inflammation, and that can help prevent bone disease. So if you want to have healthier bones and less inflammation, then eat a good, healthy vegan diet, and you'll be getting your probiotics, and you'll turn off inflammation and protect your bones. That's the study. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now, for those of you who were listening to or watching Bill Maher when he was debating with Ben Affleck, it's a little confusing because on the one hand, it sounds as if Bill Maher is making statements that are Islamophobic, and Ben is trying to challenge him on it, but there's no real articulation because there's too much talking over each other. It's just kind of a confusing shouting match. This is a little different. It depends upon who you debate and how the debate is structured as to what we learn from it. So this is a person who I've had on this program, Reza Aslan, who is challenging Bill Maher. Let's take a listen, see what you think, and then I'm going to ask you for your feedback at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888.
Well, we've got a kind of a catfight here. It's Bill Maher and Reza Aslan. Bill Maher on his program talked about how people were not giving enough attention to Islamic violence and oppression. On which planet, Bill? I believe that's all anybody talks about on TV, right? And he blamed liberals for ignoring violence and oppression that goes on in Muslim nations, a blanket statement about Muslim nations, right? Does it happen in some Muslim nations? Of course it does. And by the way, on our program, we talk about it all the time, okay? Now, when you make a blanket statement like that, you're stepping into a minefield because it's not true. Now, the guy who's going to correct your ass is Reza Aslan. Aslan, in some languages, means lion. So you're going to hear Reza roar here. He's going to go on CNN and take on Bill Maher's concept.
You know, frankly, when it comes to the topic of religion, he's not very sophisticated in the way that he thinks. I mean, the argument about the female genital mutilation being an Islamic problem is a perfect example of that. It's not an Islamic problem, it's an African problem.
Well, because he says it's a Muslim country problem. He says that in Somalia.
And that's actually empirically, factually incorrect. It's a Central African problem. Eritrea has almost 90% female genital mutilation. It's a Christian country. Ethiopia has 75% female genital mutilation. It's a Christian country. Nowhere else in the Muslim majority states is female genital mutilation an issue.
He's like, wait, what'd you say again? Oh, that was freaking awesome. So, but wait, what about the Muslim nations? Oh, 90%, 75% Christian nation. Dude, if you're going to come against Reza, you better come correct. And he ain't halfway done yet.
But again, this is the problem, is that you make these facile arguments like that women are somehow mistreated in the Muslim world. Well, that's certainly true in many Muslim-majority countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia. Do you know that Muslims have elected 7 women as their heads of states in those Muslim-majority countries? How many women do we have as head of state in the United States?
For the most part, Reza, be honest, though, for the most part, it is not a free and open society for women in those states.
Well, it's not in Iran, it's not in Saudi Arabia, it certainly is in Indonesia and Malaysia, it certainly is in Bangladesh, it certainly is in Turkey. I mean, again, this is the problem, is that you're talking about a religion of 1.5 billion people, and certainly it becomes very easy to just simply paint them all with a single brush by saying, well, in Saudi Arabia they can't drive, and so therefore that's somehow representative of Islam. It's representative of Saudi Arabia.
He's pulverizing them. Okay. My favorite part was Don Lemon, like, now be honest, it's a big problem in Muslim countries. He's like, well, actually, okay. I'm sure Don Lemon doesn't know this, Bill Maher doesn't know this, most of the people that talk about Muslim countries don't know this, but Indonesia has a much larger Muslim population than any Middle Eastern country does, okay? Bangladesh has a much larger Muslim population. India has a much larger Muslim population. Women don't have any issues there, okay? Now, look, when in countries where they do have issues, like Iran, we call them out nonstop. You know that the sons of bitches in the Iranian government the other day executed a guy for heresy because they said he did innovations in Islam. That doesn't sound so bad. That sounds pretty good, right? But they killed him for that. So that drives us crazy. We're secular. We don't like that. We hate that, right? But you've got to be accurate in your criticism. Who are you talking about? Are you talking about some poor Indonesian Malaysian person? Or are you talking about the government of Saudi Arabia? You don't know a thing. You're so uneducated. It's sad. But luckily, Reza's here to regulate. Keep on going.
I mean, I think that Bill Maher's point is that these aren't extremists. We often talk about extremists and that we should crack down on extremists. And why aren't Muslims speaking out about extremists? In Saudi Arabia, when women can't vote and they can't drive and they need permission from their husband, that's not extremists. Why aren't we talking more about what? That's not extremists. That's commonplace. Why don't we talk more about the commonplace wrongs that are happening in some of these countries?
It's extremist when compared to the rights and responsibilities of women, Muslim women around the world. It's an extremist way of dealing with it.
But it's not extremist in that. It's not extremist in that country, in Saudi Arabia. That's the norm.
Oh, no, it's not. I mean, look, Saudi Arabia is one of the most, if not the most extremist Muslim country in the world. In the month that we've been talking about ISIS and their terrible actions in Iraq and Syria, Saudi Arabia, our closest ally, has beheaded 19 people. Nobody seems to care about that because Saudi Arabia sort of preserves our national interests. Okay. You know, this is the problem, is that these kinds of conversations that we're having aren't really being had in any kind of legitimate way. We're not talking about women in the Muslim world. We're using two or three examples to justify a generalization. That's actually the definition of bigotry.
All right. Oh, damn. Damn, that was good. Okay. And by the way, again, the heart of what Bill Maher said is exactly wrong. You know who are the only people talking about the executions in Saudi Arabia? Liberals. We've talked about it endlessly on this show. This is supposed to be our top ally. Are you kidding me? They do more beheadings than ISIS does. How are they our ally? It's because they have cheap oil, and they're willing to flood the market when we tell them to lower the price of oil. So we let them get away with literally murder and decapitations and beheadings because, what, they got cheap oil. We're the only ones talking about that. You think conservatives bring that up? They hate that. You know what conservatives do? They walk around Crawford holding hands with a Saudi king and kissing him on the cheeks. That's what George W. Bush did, okay? So now get it right when you're talking about different countries. But they're not done yet. I can't believe they went back for more of this ass-handing that Reza's giving them. Give it to him one more time.
So, Reza, you don't think that there's anything more... There's the justice system in Muslim countries, you don't think, is somehow more primitive or subjugates women more than in other countries?
Did you hear what you just said? You said in Muslim countries. Mm. I just told you that Indonesia, women are absolutely 100% equal to men. In Turkey, they have had more female representatives, more female heads of state in Turkey than we have in the United States.
But in Pakistan,
stop saying things like Muslim countries.
Women are still being stoned.
And that's a problem for Pakistan. You're
right. I just want to be clear on what your point is, because I thought you and Bill Maher were saying the same thing. Your point is that Muslim countries are not to blame.
The actions of individuals and societies and countries like Iran, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia must be condemned because they don't belong in the 21st century. But to say Muslim countries as though Pakistan and Turkey are the same, as though Indonesia and Saudi Arabia are the same, as though somehow what is happening in the most extreme forms of these repressive countries, these autocratic countries, is representative of what's happening in every other Muslim country, is frankly, and I use this word seriously, stupid.
Oh, damn. Did you hear what you just said?
We heard what he just said. A little later on, Michael Moore. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. We're standing by as Robert Perry, one of the leading progressive investigative journalists in America, best known for his uncovering Iran-Contra story and Oliver North's involvement, which earned him the George Polk Award for National Reporting in 1984. He currently writes for Consortium News and has covered many important stories, including breaking the first story about the Nicaragua-Contra cocaine connection in 1985. He also broke the story of right-wing terrorism, the demise of American media, the Bush-Obama presidencies, and the rise and influence of neocons in our wars overseas. And he has contributed to, as a journalist, he worked for the Associated Press and Newsweek and PBS Frontline. He's the author of many books, including America's Stolen Narrative, and his website is consortiumnews.com. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for having me.
I read just about 10 minutes ago your latest article called New York Times Belated Admission on Contra Cocaine. Let me just quote two paragraphs for the audience. This is from Robert Perry. Nearly three decades since the stories of Nicaraguan Contra cocaine trafficking first appeared in 1985, the New York Times has finally, forthrightly, admitted the allegations were true. Although this belated acknowledgement comes in a movie review buried deep inside Sunday's paper. The review addresses the new film, Kill the Messenger, that revives the Contra cocaine charges in the context of telling the tragic tale of journalist Gary Webb, who himself revived the allegations in 1996, only to have the New York Times and other major newspapers wage a vendetta against him to destroy his career and ultimately drove him to suicide. The Times movie review by David Carr begins with a straightforward recognition of the long-denied truth to which not even the CIA has confessed. Quote, if someone told you today that there was a strong evidence that the Central Intelligence Agency once turned a blind eye to accusations of drug dealing by operatives it worked with, it might ring some distant, skeptical bell. It did. Did that really happen? That really did happen, end quote. And although the Times Review still quibbles with aspects of Webb's Dark Alliance series in the San Jose Mercury News, the Times appears to have finally thrown in the towel when it comes to the broader question of whether Webb was telling important truths. Now, that's part of what you can read on Consortium News of this really good article. Here's my two interconnected issues that, if you would please, Robert, since you were there, you had actually broken the first important stories. That tell us about how an administration and all of its cooperative agencies, the State Department, Defense Department, the CIA, lied about the Iran-Contra connections. Tell us about the laws that they broke and how they covered it up, and when exposed, how they handled it, and how to this day the Republicans, neocons, refuse to acknowledge that their shining light on the hill, Ronald Reagan, was fully aware of this. That's number one. Number two, when Gary Webb came out with his report, I did the first radio show with him. In fact, when he won the award that year for Project Censored, and it was at Columbia University, I was there with my publisher, Dan Simon, Seven Stories Press, that published his book, and to acknowledge him for outstanding reporting. And we developed a friendship, and he told me, he said, I can't believe what's happening. I said, what's that? He said, the Times, Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, everyone is attacking me. And all I'm asking is, look at my evidence. And he's not saying the CIA personally was bringing drugs in, but rather they knew who was bringing drugs in. They were aware of it, and they did nothing to stop it. But none of the media would talk with him. Instead, they attacked him until he could no longer find work. He became really depressed. I spoke with him before he committed suicide, and this guy was kryptonite. His reputation was never revived, and yet we were told lies by the major media. Could you take us on that part of this story, too? So we have one, the government complicit, and the other, the major media complicit in covering up what you had reported and what Webb had reported. Take your time. The form is yours.
Well, sure. Back in the 1980s, at the Associated Press, Brian Barger and I were working together And what we're trying to do is figure out how the Contras were supporting themselves in the field. If you remember, because of their human rights violations and because of violations of international law, the Congress had cut the funding for the Contras. They refused to allow the CIA to continue to support the Contras. But the funding continued. And so what Barger and I were trying to figure out was where the money was coming from. And as we went into this deeper and deeper story, obviously there were several sources of funding, some of it being arranged by the White House through third countries. Some of that became later known as the Iran-Contra scandal. But another part of it was, and we stumbled upon this as we were working on this story, was that basically all the major Contra groups were augmenting their money by collaborating with drug traffickers, helping them transport cocaine primarily into the United States. They were working with the Medellin cartel. They were working with Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega. They were working with a variety of the drug cartels operating in Central America. And this was solidly reported by the Associated Press when we published that first story in December of 1985. We had not only sources inside the Contra operations from among their supporters, but we also had Drug Enforcement Administration and a National Security Council official who were providing us inside information about what the government knew. And it was quite clear that the Reagan administration knew a great deal about what their clients were doing and this involvement with drug trafficking. It also became clear over time that the Reagan administration was trying to cover up these crimes because, for political reasons, there was a fear that if this were accepted, if this were fully exposed and accepted as real by the American public, there would be no way to get renewed funding for the Contras. And that was always a very close vote, a matter of a few switches here or there in Congress. Could either provide the funding through the CIA or cut it off. So there was always this hypersensitivity inside the Reagan administration about suppressing any negative information about the Contras because it would have this effect in Congress and in the public. And perhaps the most damaging piece would have been if the American people recognized that the Reagan administration was covering for drug traffickers. Especially with the whole war on drugs, just say no, and so forth. So when our story was first published in late 1985, it was also a hard story to report. It's not an easy story to get. You have to develop sensitive sources. You also have to spend a lot of time in Central America or in Miami working with the Contras and figuring out finding dissidents within their movement to talk to you. So instead of doing that, the New York Times and the Washington Post in particular decided to simply support the Reagan administration in tearing down our stories. And what we saw was a number of ridiculous pieces done by the New York Times trying to essentially claim there's no there there regarding the Contra drugs. This is in 1986. And even after Senator John Kerry headed up an investigation in Congress, which developed a lot of new information about how the Reagan administration knew what the Contras were up to with drug trafficking, and even the Reagan administration had even hired airlines that the Contras were using to help supply the Contras, knowing that those networks of airlines were also involved in flying drugs. So this was even when John Kerry came out with that report in early 1989, the response was to either bury the story or to laugh at Kerry, or it was a remarkable a failure of responsibility on the part of these major news organizations, which had kind of bought into the Reagan foreign policy line, sort of the neoconservative, we've got to go into these countries and knock the crap out of some of them, and show how tough we are. That was a position that this may sound odd to some people, but that was where many of the news executives at these major news organizations like the New York Times and the Washington Post, this is where they were. This is where their heads were. And I worked for the Post company when I went to Newsweek, and I saw it firsthand that there was this strong support within the Post Newsweek company for this kind of aggressive foreign policy abroad. They didn't want to have stories that shed bad light on those sorts of events. So you saw this kind of collaboration, even back in the 1980s, between the Reagan administration, later the Bush 1 administration, and the press, in terms of not wanting those kinds of stories to be made available to the American people. So they were always dismissed or buried or attacked, that sort of thing. Now, this even continued after the arrest and prosecution of Manuel Noriega in 1991, even when the Bush administration then put on witnesses who said, yes, we were drug traffickers involved with Noriega, and by the way, we were also helping the Nicaraguan Contras. So even though it was being put out as federal testimony in a major criminal case, it was still in this sort of odd way dismissed or ignored, or there was an effort to sort of just never deal with it. And that's where it was until 1996, when Gary Webb revived the story in the San Jose Mercury News. And what he did, which is something that we did not do, and to his credit he did this, he looked at the impact of the drugs once they got to the United States. Our stories had been about them coming in from Central America and South America, and the efforts by the Reagan administration to not crack down on these Contra groups doing this. Where Webb took the story was what happened after the drugs got here and how some of those drugs went into groups, gangs, and criminal enterprises that were developing crack cocaine at that time, which then became this terrible effect across the United States, especially in African American communities, but across the country generally. So Webb was looking at that part of the story, and when this became an issue that the Congressional Black Caucus then began to focus on, you saw the same newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, in part because Webb's story focused on Los Angeles. These same big news organizations circled the wagons around the CIA and protected them, and protected themselves, because many of the same journalists who had buried the stories or attacked the stories in the 1980s, they were now bureau chiefs. They were now deputy managing editors. They'd moved up inside their organizations. And so they were very complicit in wanting to not accept that this story was important, because to accept that would have meant that they would have to look at what they did a decade earlier, which was to sit on a very important story and suppress it. So they just continued suppressing it. And they attacked Webb. They went with a microscope through his story, trying to find little things that they could quibble about rather than looking at the larger picture. The larger picture was not whether Gary Webb wrote a perfect story. It was whether or not the U.S. government was complicit in the cocaine trade by allowing these clients, the Contras, to be shipping drugs or helping cartels ship drugs into the United States and the consequences of that. That was the big story. It wasn't whether Gary Webb was a perfect human being and a perfect journalist. But the second part, whether Gary Webb was a perfect journalist, became the front page stories, attacking Webb. And frankly, it was bizarre because this was the first time that the Contra drug story made it onto the front pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times. Was not about the substance, not about what the government had done or what the Contras had done. These were stories attacking Gary Webb and attacking the African American community for being conspiracy theorists, was how it was being portrayed, that the African Americans were conspiracy prone, was one of the phrases used. So you saw this truly disgraceful behavior by the major news organizations of the United States, tearing down an honest reporter, destroying him, destroying his career, ultimately destroying his marriage and driving him to suicide because he couldn't find work. He couldn't pay his bills. He couldn't pay his child support. He was being kicked out of the house he was living in. He was going to have to move in with his mother. He was 49 years old. And so this was a situation that was created by the major national news media. Now, the irony of this, the cruel irony of this, is that because of Webb's series, the Central Intelligence Agency actually began an investigation, their first serious investigation of this problem. They'd done a couple of cover-up investigations back in the 80s, but finally they had an honest inspector general in Frederick Hitz, and he did a pretty thorough investigation. And he published his findings in 1998 in two volumes, and the second volume in particular was devastating. It was effectively an institutional confession by the Central Intelligence Agency that, yes, the Contras had been involved in drug trafficking, much more so than Brian Barger and I knew for AP, or more than Gary Webb ever knew. They were much more involved, and the U.S. government knew much more about it than we'd ever suspected. They knew from the very beginning of the Contra movement back in 1981 that Contras were involved in drug trafficking, and this implicated some of the top people in the organizations. And they followed it all the way through the 1980s with reporting from the field. And it showed also that CIA officials tried to step in when there were investigations by the Drug Enforcement Administration that threatened to expose the Contra role in the drug trafficking. There were efforts by the CIA to block those investigations, to essentially have them not be pursued. And when Kerry tried to investigate it, information, evidence was withheld from him because it would have shown that some of the key Contra figures that were being, even some brought in by the CIA itself, were known to be involved with drug trafficking. So there was all this amazing evidence that the CIA itself put out. But the New York Times sort of treated it in rather cursory fashion. They did at least do something with it. The Washington Post waited a month or so and then did some story that was completely off point. Didn't really mention what the CIA was admitting to. And the LA Times, which had devoted 17 staff people to tear down Gary Webb's story, they did not write a single article about this major report that came out by the CIA. So what happened was Webb's reputation was never repaired. He'd been forced out of his newspaper because when the pressure really built, his editors caved under the pressure. They sold him down the river, basically. And there was never a moment where people said, you know, he was right, and he was vindicated. This was allowed to remain kind of a story that always was under the radar, never was something focused on. And so that was a situation that continued on for Gary Webb until the end of his life in December of 2004. And after he died, I received a call from the LA Times. That's how I first heard of his death. And the reporter knew that I was one of the very few journalists in Washington who had defended Webb and his series. And I told the reporter that you should say something in the obituary about the debt that American history owes to Gary Webb, because if it were not for Webb and his courage in doing that series, we would not have known all these things that the CIA had confessed to. And I said, but you'll have a problem at the LA Times in writing that obit, because you've never even written a story about what the CIA confessed to. And you'll go back into your library or morgue, and you will pull out the last story that you did, and you won't show that Webb was vindicated. And I guess not to my surprise, but to my disappointment, the LA Times ignored what I told them. They left out my comments. They included comments of people very critical of Webb in his obit. It was kind of an obit that read a bit like something you would read from after some organized crime figure had died. Not a brave journalist. And they put out this nasty obituary, which the Washington Post then republished a day or so later. And that was sort of the epitaph, if you will, for Gary Webb as far as the major news organizations were concerned.
Well, Robert Webb.
And some of us have you know, afterwards, I began every year on the internet.
Robert, we're out of time for this segment. But I'm asking people to read your piece on Gary Webb and the New York Times, and also, for goodness sakes, read America's Stolen Narrative, from Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. The website is consortiumnews.com. Robert Perry from Washington, D.C. Robert, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us on Gary Webb. I haven't seen Kill the Messenger about this. I hope that it tells the truth and at least lets this part of the story that you're telling us that the world does not know about, that the CIA had to come forward with its own internal investigation and admit it had been in the drug business by supporting the Contras who were in the drug business. And Gary Webb was right. You exposed it in 1985. He exposed it again in 1996, but on the streets of Southeast Los Angeles and showed its impact. The media gathered around the CIA and the administration, defended them. They lied. And it's virtually sociopathic what happened. But thank you for correcting history, Robert Perry. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. We'll have one more comment on this, but I ask people for feedback, and I do want to take a call. Let's say hello to Alexandra from New York. Feedback before we go to our final segment with Sander Hicks from Brooklyn, also about the media and the CIA takedown of Gary Webb. Alexander, your turn.
Hey, Gary. Good afternoon, and it's great to talk to you. And I've been listening to you for many, many, many years, have a lot of your books. And I would like to say that Bill Maher is just about, he's a mouthpiece for his opinions. And he has a political show. It's not a real news show. It's a political show with Bill Maher's spin on everything. I mean, like most people in entertainment, he's got to cater to his audience. And I find that his comments pretty much sound like what the middle ground in America would like to believe about Islam. And also, you know, Ben Affleck, he's a Christian. Bill Maher is he's Jewish, but he's an atheist. I mean, he's a practicing atheist. So he doesn't believe in any of the, belief systems, the Muslim, Jewish, or Christian belief system. And, I mean, there's nobody to represent the Islamic opinion or the Islamic side on his show. So it's just very bizarre, you know, to make such blanket statements about a religion.
I have no one to
defend himself. Yeah.
That's why we did the segment. We try to bring some reasoned, scholarly voices who have no axe to grind to give their perspective. Thank you very much. I appreciate calling in. Before we go to Sander Hicks to finish off our show, let me mention that I'm still interviewing for personal assistant, interviewing for store manager, and I'm going to be meeting tonight at 6 o'clock for people who are interested in those two really exciting good jobs. You have to call 646-926-5422 if you want to be interviewed, 646-926-5422. Let's go over to Brooklyn and say hello to Sander Hicks, a media activist and founding publisher of Soft Skull Press, which won Outstanding Independent Publisher of the Year Awards and was responsible for the biography of George Bush, Fortunate Son. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary Knoll.
Tell us your input about Gary Webb, the immediate takedown of him, and the CIA being complicit in it.
Sure. Well, I was the publisher of Jim Hatfield's book, Fortunate Son, George W. Bush and the Making of an American President, in 1999, 2000, and 2001. And similar to Gary Webb, Jim Hatfield committed suicide, and some people questioned whether it was a suicide, and that happened in the summer of 2001, right before 9/11. And so when Gary Webb died in December of 2004, it was pretty devastating to me personally. I was still really kind of mourning Jim Hatfield, and there was beginning to be a 9/11 truth movement, and just earlier in San Francisco, about a year or so earlier, I had spoken at the very first 9/11 truth event, and I actually was able to contact Gary Webb over email and do an interview with him about CIA narcotics trafficking, and he was more than happy to help edify me and help flesh out the presentation that I gave that day in San Francisco.
Okay. We're coming up to the end of the program. Could you give us a brief synopsis of the most important and relevant point that Gary shared with you about the CIA-Contra connection?
Right. Well, I want to say that it's a little bit more nuanced. I think a lot of people veer towards thinking that the CIA was selling crack. But really what happened was through the shadow government operatives, through a series of front companies and connections, what happened was that the CIA facilitated a great amount of powder cocaine to come into Los Angeles so that the crack epidemic could happen. You know, it could not have happened without an increased amount of powder cocaine. And like Malcolm X said, don't look to poor blacks when you're looking to find out who's running the drug war, the drug trade. It's not like poor blacks have the airplanes and the capital and the transportation mechanism to foment the drug trade upon themselves. It really is the shadow state that is responsible.
Much like Air America did in Vietnam, facilitating heroin going out of the Golden Triangle and then distribution points in the United States. What you're saying, and also what Mr. Baker was saying, is that the CIA had individuals associated with the Contras protecting them, seeing that they got weapons, and in return, these Contra heads and people associated were using the CIA front companies to get their product without being arrested into the United States. They weren't standing on a street corner selling heroin or crack cocaine, but they were turning a blind eye to the fact that they knew who was, how it was done, and that's all been fully documented. And no one was ever held accountable. Not a single CIA person was ever held accountable, State Department person, White House person, yet they were all complicit.
Absolutely, Gary. You can look back to Vietnam, or you could look also to 9/11. Mohammed Atta had some interesting connections to cocaine and heroin trade that was going on when he was training in Florida on the west side of the Florida Peninsula there, a former Air Force air base.
You know, Sander, I know we're out of time, but I know you have a lot of insight on that part of the 9/11 story and the redacted story that the 9/11 Commission has been kept secret. So I'm going to have you back just to talk about that. All right?
Great. Thank you so much, Gary.
Thank you for sharing. Sander Hooks, S-A-N-D-E-R, Hicks, H-I-C-K-S. And he's written several books, his latest being Slingshot to the Juggernaut, Total Resistance to the Death of Machine Man's Complete Love of the Truth. Now, that's a long title. Shorten the title before you come on next time. I'm Gary Null. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's show. Have a nice day, everyone. Luann Panessi in studio. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. So I wanted to revisit the situation I shared with you yesterday. It's not a unique one where a gentleman is motivated by something that you've said or something that he's read in one of your books, and then he leaves the environment. He's good for about a year or so, and then we fall back into old habits. And the question is, how do we change and maintain that change if, A, some people don't have the preparatory skills to make the change, or if there's no one there to just constantly motivate
us? It's not the skills. You can take a weekend and go to one of the workshops and have all the skills you want. There are people who I won't mention who spend $75,000 to come and sit and meditate with them, smile, look like Francis the Talking Mule. And what does, if you look at his picture beside it, I couldn't tell one from the other. And except money was coming out of one of their ears. Motivating people by saying, we're going to give you all that you need to succeed in life. This is externalizing our angst. If you want to get to the next chapter of your life and turn around and take an honest look at how much mold there is currently in your life, conscious mold, emotional mold, you've been living in it, you've been living in just a septic tank, then it doesn't take another class, another workshop, another meditation. It simply takes a realization that you better get back to being a spiritual person. This has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with a consciousness that your life should be the center of your universe and your ethics are what guides you. Now, your ethics and how you treat people, looking for the sacred in someone. Now, they may not be sacred. They may manifest evil, in which case you call it out. But at least you're giving them the opportunity to show the best they can be if they choose to. Therefore, there's the idea that we can all quantitatively come back to where we originated with pure intent. So what then is the meaning of your life? If you don't have a meaning to your life, how are you going to go on a journey to your life? Where are you going to go? What path are you going to take? Someone else's path? Your latest guru? The latest book? The secret? Oprah? Whose life are you going to live? Because we seem to have a hard time living our own lives. Even when we're successful, more often than not, our success is motivated by a deep insecurity that if we don't keep doing more of the same, we'll wake up alone and abandoned. This fear of abandonment, this fear of being alone, it causes most people to make inappropriate decisions. That's an inappropriate, maladaptive decision. So never make important life decisions in a maladaptive mindset. Go to a clear space, sit, relax, meditate, reflect. And what your heart tells you, that's the conscious spiritual self telling you, this is the light of your life, live it. And then you will have the ability to do whatever you want to do. You won't need any coach, you won't need a life coach, you won't need a psychotherapist, you won't need anyone. You're there. Otherwise, you're going to spend your whole life acting like you're a character in a bad Woody Allen film, and there are only bad Woody Allen films. All right, he hadn't had a funny one since Bananas. So we're not needing all that we've been told we have to have, because once you start getting on that idea that you need more and more and more, then you're never confident that you have enough to start your journey. You simply have to clear yourself of all the debris in your life. There's an old Chinese saying, you cannot travel far unless you travel light. So you must eliminate everything that's holding you back and holding you down. Get rid of it. It's just clutter. Friendship clutter, relationship clutter, emotional clutter, stuff clutter. Get rid of all. And then say, I'm taking the next step. And it has to be a conscious, spiritual step. Then you won't have to get off your journey again. Thanks, Luann. Let's say hello to Wash down in Florida, in a hidden place, hiding under a giant oak tree in a tunnel, Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
That's right. Speaking of tunnel, we'll be talking about claims of light at the end of the bankruptcy tunnel in Detroit. And we'll be talking about lentils and life in Obama's prosperous America.
Lentils and life. Now, that's an interesting title. I've never heard that before.
Lentils and life.
All right. Utrecht Lead. And Utrecht is coming to New York. Aren't you coming in the next week?
Next week, yes.
Oh, that's great. We're looking forward. Have you got, are all lined up to lecture?
I'm going to let you know. I'm pretty good.
Not at the last moment. I could just see her down on the street at 84th and Broadway. I'm going to lecture now. Everyone upstairs. Give us a couple days' notice and we'll get the word out for you. All right?
Thank you. Thank you. Will do.
Utrecht Lead right now.
Our program director is Jason Taubenfeld. The archive team is Sharon Pride and Casey Holford. And our head engineer is Giselle Hernandez. You can download past programs by visiting our archives at prn.fm.